At least she knew she would no longer dwell with complacency under Gaulois' roof. A pain struck at her heart. They had been wedded under Roman law, and by that law Gaulois had absolute power over their daughter, Morgaine. Somehow she must contrive to dissemble until she could get Morgaine away to a place of safety. She could perhaps send her to Vivian at the Holy Isle for fostering. She left the jewels Gaulois had given her lying on the bed, packing with her only the gown she had woven with her own hands at Tintagel, and for jewels only the moonstone Vivian had given her. Later she realized it was this moment or two of delay which had cost her escape. For while she was laying out the gifts he had given her on the bed, separating her own things from them, Gaulois came back into the room. He cast one swift glance at her packed saddlebags and nodded curtly. "Good," he said. "You are making ready to ride. We will leave before sunset."
"What do you mean, Gaulois?"
"I mean that I have cast back my oath in Uther's face and told him what I should have told him at once. Henceforth, we are enemies. I go now to organize the defense of the West against the Saxons and the Irish, should they come there. I have told him that if he seeks to bring his armies into my country, I will hang him, like the felon he is, from any handy tree."
She stared at him. At last she said, "You are mad, my husband. The men of Cornwall cannot hold the West Country alone if the Saxons should come there in force. Ambrosius knew that. The Merlin knows that. God help me, I know it. And I am no more than a home-keeping woman. Will you strike down in one moment of madness everything that Ambrosius lived for and spent his last years struggling for because of some insane quarrel with Uther over your own mad jealousy?"
"You are quick to care for Uther."
"I should be quick to pity the Saxon chief himself if he lost his hardiest supporters in a quarrel with no foundation." "In God's name, Gaulois, for our very lives, and the lives of the people who look to you for help if the Saxons come, I beg of you to amend this quarrel with Uther, and not to break up the alliance this way. Lot has already gone. If you go, there will be none but treaty troops, and a few minor kings to follow him in the defence of Britain." She shook her head in despair. "Would that I had thrown myself from the cliffs at Tintagel before ever I came to Londinium. I will take any oath you like that I have never so much as touched Uther Pendragon's lips." "Will you break the alliance for which Ambrosius died because of a woman?" Gaulois glowered at her and said,
"Even had Uther never set eyes on you, my lady, I should not in conscience follow a man of lewdness, so bad a Christian. I trust Lot not at all, but I now know that I should trust Uther less. I should have listened from the first to the voice of my conscience, and I would never have agreed to support him at all. Put my clothing into the other saddlebag. I have sent for the horses and our men-at-arms."
She looked at his implacable face and knew that if she protested he would beat her again. Silently, with seething anger, she obeyed. Now she was trapped. She couldn't flee, not even to the Holy Isle under her sister's protection. Not while Gaulois held her daughter at Tintagel. She was still laying folded shirts and tunics into the saddlebags when she heard alarm bells begin to ring. Gaulois said curtly, "Stay here," and hurried out of the house. Angry, Igraine hurried after him, only to find herself faced by a burly man-at-arms, one of Gaulois's men she hadn't seen before. He thrust his pike sideways across the house door, preventing her from stepping across the sill. His Cornish dialect was so thick that she could hardly understand his words, but she made out that the Duke had commanded his lady was to keep safely within the house. He was there, to see that she stayed so. It would be beneath her dignity to struggle with the man, and she had a shrewd suspicion that if she did, he would simply bundle her like a sack of meal across the threshold. In the end, she sighed and went back inside the house, finishing her packing. From the street she heard cries and clamour, the sounds of men running, bells ringing in the nearby church, although it wasn't the hour for services. Once she heard a clashing of swords, and wondered if the Saxons were in the city and among them. It would indeed be a good time for an attack when Ambrosius's chiefs were all at odds. Well, that would solve one of her problems. But what would become of Morgaine, alone at Tintagel? The day wore on, and near nightfall Igraine began to be afraid. Were the Saxons at the gates of the city? Had Uther and Gorlois quarrelled again? Was one or the other of them dead? When at last Gorlois thrust open the door of the room, she was almost glad to see him. His face was drawn and distant, his jaw clenched as if in great grief, but his words to Igraine were brief and uncompromising. "We ride at nightfall. Can you keep your saddle, or shall I have one of my men carry you on a pillion? We shall have no time to delay for a lady's pace." She wanted to batter at him with a thousand questions, but she wouldn't give him the satisfaction of seeming to care. "While you can ride, my husband, I can keep to my saddle."
"See that you do, then, for we shall not halt long enough for you to change your mind. Wear your warmest cloak. It will be cold riding at night, and the sea fog is coming in."
Igraine tied up her hair into a knot, and wrapped her thick cloak over the tunic and breeches she always put on for riding. Gorlois lifted her to the horse's back. The street was thickly clustered with the dark forms of men-at-arms with their long spears. Gorlois spoke in low tones to one of the captains, then strode back and mounted. There were a dozen horsemen and soldiers riding behind Gorlois and Igraine. He took the reins of Igraine's horse himself and said with an angry jerk of his head, "Come." She wasn't sure of the way. She rode in silence where Gorlois led through the falling dusk. Somewhere against the sky there was fire, but Igraine didn't know whether it was a soldier's watchfire, or a house somewhere in flames, or simply the cooking fires of the travelling peddlers encamped in the marketplace. She had never learned her way through the thickly clustered houses and streets to the river, but as the thick fog began to blow in wisps across their path, she supposed they were coming to the river bank, and after a time she heard the creaking of the rope windlass which controlled the heavy planking rafts of the ferry. One of Gaulois's men, dismounting, led her horse aboard. Gorlois rode at her side. A few of the men swam their horses. She realized it must be very late. At this time of year the light lingered long, and it was almost unheard of to ride at night. Then she heard a cry from the shore. "They are going! They are going! First Lot, and then my Lord of Cornwall. And we are unprotected. All the soldiers are leaving the town. What will we do when the Saxons land on the south coast?" "Cowards!" someone yelled from the shore as the ferry, with a great creaking, began to move away. "Cowards, running away with the countryside aflame." A stone came whizzing out of the dark. It struck one of the men-at-arms on his leather breastplate. He swore, but Gorlois spoke to him in a sharp undertone, and he grumbled into silence. There were a few other insults hurled from the shore, and a few more stones, but they were quickly out of range. As her eyes grew accustomed to the dark, Igraine could see Gorlois, his face pale and set like a marble statue. He didn't speak to her all that night, although they rode till dawn, and even when the dawn came up, red and dripping behind them, turning the world to crimson fog, they stopped only a little while for horses and men to rest. Gorlois laid a cloak for Igraine to lie down on for a little while, and brought us some hard bread and cheese and a cup of wine.
Soldiers' rations.
But still, he didn't speak to her. She was weary and bruised from riding and confused. She knew that Gaulois had quarrelled with Uther and withdrawn his men, but nothing more. Would Uther have let him go without protest? Well, Lot had been let go. After a short rest, Gaulois brought the horses again and would have lifted her into the saddle. But here Igraine rebelled. "I will ride no further until you tell me where we ride and why." She kept her voice down, not wanting to shame Gaulois before his men. But she faced him fearlessly. "Why do we steal from Londinium like thieves in the night? Now you will tell me what is happening, unless you wish to have me tied to my horse's back and carry me screaming aloud all the way to Cornwall."
"Do you think I wouldn't do that if I must?" Gaulois said. "Don't seek to cross me, you for whom I have forsworn a lifetime of honour and oaths kept, and set the memory of my king at nothing."
"How can you dare to blame me for that?" Igraine flung at him. "You did it not for me, but for your own insane jealousy. I am innocent of whatever sins your evil mind believes I have committed."
"Silence, woman. Uther, too, swore that you were innocent of wrong. But you are a woman, and you put some enchantment on him, I suppose. I went to Uther hoping to mend this quarrel. And do you know what proffer that evil and lustful man made to me? He demanded of me that I should divorce you and give you to him."
Igraine stared at him with wide-open eyes. "If you think so evil of me that I am adulteress, witch, all these ill things, why then did you not rejoice at the prospect of getting quit of me so simply?" And inside her was a new rage, that even Uther should think of her as a woman to be given away without her own consent. But he went to Gaulois, and besought him to give the unwanted woman, even as Gaulois himself had asked her of the Lady of Avalon. Was she a horse to be sold at the spring fair, then? One part of her quivered with a secret pleasure. Uther wanted her. He wanted her enough that he would quarrel with Gaulois and alienate his allies by this quarrel over a woman. And with another part of her being, she was enraged. Why had he not besought her of herself that she should put away Gaulois and come to him of her free will? But Gaulois was attending seriously to her question. "You swore to me that you were not an adulteress. And no Christian man may put his wife away, save for the sole cause of adultery." Between impatience and sudden compunction, Igraine held her peace. She couldn't be grateful to him, but at least he had listened to what she said. Yet it occurred to her that it was mostly his pride. Even if he believed she had betrayed him, he wouldn't want his soldiers to think that his young wife preferred another man to himself. Perhaps he would even rather condone the sin of adultery than let them think he could not keep the loyalty of a young woman. She said, "Gaulois." But he silenced her with a gesture. "Enough. I have no patience to change many words with you. Once in Tintagel, there you may forget this folly at leisure. As for the Pendragon, he will have quite enough to do at war on the Saxon shores. If you were glamoured by him, well, you are young and a woman, with small knowledge of the world or of men. I will reproach you no more. Within a year or two you will have a son to take your mind from this man who has struck your fancy." In silence, Igraine allowed Gaulois to lift her to her horse. He must believe whatever it was that he believed. There was nothing she could say to penetrate that iron surface. Yet her mind went back stubbornly to what Vivian and the Merlin had said, that her destiny and Uther's were bound. After her dream, she believed it. She knew why they had come back together. She had begun to accept that this was the will of the gods. Yet here she was, riding away from Londinium with Gaulois, the alliance in ruins, and Gaulois evidently determined that Uther never set eyes on her again. Certainly, with a war on the Saxon shores, Uther would have no leisure to journey to the world's end at Tintagel. And even if he could, there was no way he could make his way into that castle, which could be defended by only a few men until the sky fell. Gaulois could leave her there, and there she would stay till she was an old woman, shut up bleakly behind walls and the great chasms and crags of rock. Igraine put her cloak over her face and wept. She would never see Uther again. All the plans of the Merlin were in rack and ruin. She was bound to an old man she hated. She knew now that she hated him, which she had never before allowed herself to know. And the man she loved could think of nothing better to do than to try and bully the proud Gaulois into giving her up of his own free will. Later, she thought she must have wept all through the long journey, all the days and nights which they travelled across the moors and down through the valleys of Cornwall. On the second night they camped and pitched tents for a proper rest. She welcomed hot food and a chance to sleep within a tent, even though she knew she could no longer avoid Gauloise's bed. She could not cry out and struggle with him, not when they slept in a tent ringed about by his soldiers. She had been his wife 4 years. No one alive would believe a tale of ravishment. She wouldn't have the strength to fight him, nor would she want to lose her dignity in a sordid struggle. She set her teeth and resolved to let him do as he would, although she wished she had some of the charms which were said to protect the maidens of the goddess. When they lay with men at the Beltane fires, they conceived only when they willed it so. It seemed too bitter that he should beget the son he wanted when she was humbled this way, beaten down utterly. The Merlin had said it, "You will bear Gaulois no son." But she didn't trust to the Merlin's prophecy, not now when she saw the wreck of all his plans. Cruel, scheming old man! He used her as men had always used their daughters since the Romans came. Pawns who should marry this man or that as their fathers desired. Chattels like a horse or a milk-goat. She had found some peace with Gaulois, and that peace had been broken, cruelly and for nothing. She wept silently as she made ready for bed, resigned, despairing, not even confident enough of her own power to drive him away with angry words. She could see from his manner that he was ready to prove himself in possession of her, to drive away memories of any other man by forcing her to take heed of him in the only way he could enforce himself upon her. His familiar hands on her, his face over her in the dark, were like those of a stranger. And yet, when he drew her to him, he was unable, limp and powerless. And although he pulled and clasped her, trying desperately to rouse himself, it came to nothing. And at last he let her go with a furious whispered curse. "Have you put some spell upon my manhood, you accursed bitch?" "I have not," she said, low, with contempt. "Although, indeed, if I knew such spells, I would have been glad to do so, my strong and gallant husband. Do you expect me to weep because you cannot take me by force? Try it, and I shall lie here and laugh into your face." For a moment he raised himself, clenching his fist. "Yes," she said. "Strike me. It will not be the first time. And perhaps it will make you feel enough like a man that your spear will rise into action." With a furious oath he turned his back on her and lay down again. But Igraine lay awake, shaking, knowing that she had had her revenge. And indeed, all the way to Cornwall, no matter how he tried, Gorlois found himself powerless to touch her, until at last Igraine began to wonder if indeed, without being aware of it, her very righteous wrath had indeed cast some enchantment on his manhood. Even then she knew, with the sure intuition of the priestess trained, that he would never be potent with her again. Chapter 6 Cornwall seemed more than ever at the very end of the world. In those first days after Gorlois had left her there under guard, coldly silent now, and without a word for her, good or bad, Igraine had found herself wondering whether Tintagel existed at all in the real world any more, or whether, like Avalon, it existed only in the Mist Kingdom, the Fairy Kingdom, bearing no relationship to the world she had visited in her one brief venture outside. Even during this brief absence it seemed that Morgaine had grown from babe to small girl, a serious, quiet small girl, who questioned incessantly everything she saw. Morgause, too, had grown, her body rounding, her childish face taking on definition, with its high cheekbones and long-lashed eyes under dark brows. She was, Igraine thought, beautiful, not aware that Morgause was the twin of herself at 14. Morgause was ecstatic with the gifts and fairings Igraine had brought her. She frisked around Igraine like a playful puppy, and around Gorlois, too. She chattered to him excitedly, practised sidelong looks, and tried to sit in his lap as if she were a child Morgaine's age. Igraine saw that Gorlois didn't laugh and push her off like a puppy, but stroked the long red hair, smiling, and pinched her cheek. "You are too big for such foolishness, Morgause," she said sharply. "Say your thanks to my lord of Cornwall, and take your fairings to your room. And put away the silks, for you will not wear such things till you are grown. Don't think to play the lady here just yet." Morgause gathered up the pretty things and went weeping to her room. Igraine saw that Gorlois followed the girl with his eyes. She thought, appalled, "Morgause is only 14. Then remembered in dismay that she herself had been but a year older when she was given to Gorlois as his bride. Later she saw them together in the hall, Morgause laying her head confidingly on Gorlois's shoulder, and saw the look in her husband's eyes. Hard anger struck her, not so much for the girl as for Gorlois. She saw that they moved uneasily apart as she came into the hall, and when Gorlois had gone away, she looked at Morgause, her eyes unsparing, until Morgause giggled uneasily and stared at the floor. "Why are you looking at me like that, Igraine? Are you afraid that Gorlois likes me better than you?" "Gorlois was too old for me. Is he not that much older than you? With you he thinks he would have me back as he first knew me. Too young to say him nay or to look at another man. I am no longer a pliant girl, but a woman with a mind of her own, and perhaps he thinks you would be easier to deal with." "Perhaps then," Morgause said, insolent now, "you should look to keeping your own husband content instead of complaining that some other woman can do for him what you cannot." Igraine raised her hand to slap the girl, and by sheer force of will kept herself still. She said, summoning all her self-discipline, "Do you think it matters to me whom Gorlois takes to his bed? I am certain he has had his share of trollops, but I would rather my sister was not among them. I have no wish for his embraces, and if I hated you, I would give you to him willingly. But you are too young, as I was too young. And Gorlois is a Christian man. If you let him lie with you, and he gets you with child, he will have no choice but to marry you off in haste to whatever man-at-arms will have used goods. These Romans are not like our own people, Morgause. Gaulois may be smitten with you, but he will not put me away and take you to wife, believe me. Among our own people, maidenhood is of no great consequence. A woman of proven fertility, swelling with a healthy child, is a most desirable wife. But it is not so with these Christians, I tell you. They will treat you as one shamed, and the man he persuades to marry you will make you suffer all your life long that he did not have the planting of the child you bear. Is that what you want, Morgause, who could marry a king if you chose? Will you throw yourself away, sister, to spite me? Morgause went pale. I had no idea, she whispered. Oh, no. I do not want to be shamed. Igraine, forgive me. Igraine kissed her and gave her the silver mirror and the amber necklace, and Morgause stared at her. But these are Gauloise's gifts. I have sworn I will never again wear his gifts, she said. They are yours, for that king the Merlin saw in your future sister. But you must keep yourself chaste till he comes for you. Have no fear, Morgause said, and smiled again. Igraine was glad that this reminder had caught Morgause's ambition. Morgause was cool and calculating. She would never be swayed by emotion or impulse. Igraine wished, watching her, that she too had been born without the capacity to love. I wish I could be content with Gaulois, or that I could seek coldly, as Morgause would surely do, to rid myself of Gaulois and be Uther's queen. Gaulois stayed at Tintagel only 4 days, and she was glad to see him go. He left a dozen men-at-arms at Tintagel, and when he left, he called her to him. "You and the child will be safe here, and well guarded," he said curtly. "I go to gather the men of Cornwall against Irish raiders or Northmen, or against Uther, should he seek to come and take what is not his own, woman or castle. "I think Uther will have too much to do in his own country for that," Igraine said, tightening her mouth against despair. "God grant it," Gaulois said, "for we have enough enemies without him too. But I could wish him to come, so that I might show him Cornwall is not his, as he thinks all else is his own for the taking." To that Igraine said nothing. Gaulois rode away with his men, and Igraine was left to set her house in order, to recover her old closeness with her child, to try to mend her broken friendship with her sister Morgause. But the thought of Uther was always with her, busy herself as she might with domestic tasks. It wasn't even the real Uther who haunted her, the man she had seen in orchard and court and in the church, impulsive and a little boyish, even somewhat boorish and clumsy. That Uther, the Pendragon, the High King, frightened her a little. She thought she might even be a little afraid of him, as she had once been of Gaulois. When she thought of Uther the man, thought of kisses and embraces, and what more he might desire of her, at times she felt that melting sweetness she had known in her dream, but at other times she was seized with a panic terror, like the ravished child who had risen the morning after her wedding, cold with fear and dread. The thought of the act of marriage seemed terrifying, and even grotesque to her, as it had seemed then. What came back to her, again and again in the silence of the night when she lay with Morgaine sleeping at her side, or when she sat on the terrace by the sea and guided her daughter's hands in her first clumsy attempts to spin, was the other Uther, the Uther she had known at the Ring of Stones outside time and ordinary place, the priest of Atlantis with whom she had shared the mysteries. That Uther she knew she would love as her own life, that she could never fear him or dread him, and whatever happened between them, it would be a sweetness, a joy greater than she had ever known. Quite simply, when she came near him, she knew that she had discovered some lost part of herself. With him, she was whole.
Whatever might happen between them as ordinary man and woman, something lay beyond it which would never die or lessen in its intensity.
They shared a destiny, and somehow they must fulfill it together. And often, when she had come so far in her thoughts, she would stop and stare at herself in disbelief. Was she mad with her fancies of shared destiny in the other half of her soul?
Surely the facts were simpler and less pretty. She, a married woman, a decent matron, and the mother of a child, had simply grown besotted with a younger and handsomer man than her lawful husband, and had fallen into a daydream of him, and thereby quarrelled with the good and honourable man to whom she had been given. And she would sit and spin, gritting her teeth with frantic guilt, and wonder if her whole life was to be spent in atonement for a sin only half-consciously committed. The spring wore away into summer, and the Beltane fires were long past. Heat spread its haze over the land, and the sea lay blue and so clear that it seemed at times that far away in the clouds Igraine could see the forgotten cities of Lyonesse and Atlantis. The days had begun to shorten, and there was sometimes frost in the nights again, when Igraine heard the first far rumblings of war. The men-at-arms brought news from the market-town that there had been Irish raiders on the coast, that they had burnt a village and a church, and carried off one or two women. And there were armies, not those commanded by Gaulois, marching west into the summer country, and north to Wales.
"What armies?" Igraine asked the man, and he said,
"I don't know, lady, for I didn't see them. Those who did said they bore eagles like the Roman legions of the old days, which is impossible. But he said, also, that they bore a red dragon on their banner."
"Uther," thought Igraine with a pang, "Uther is near, and he will not even know where I am." Only then did she ask for news of Gaulois, and the man told her that her husband, too, was in the summer country, and that the armies were making some sort of council there. She gazed long into her old bronze mirror that night, wishing that it were the scrying glass of a priestess that could see what was happening far away. She longed to take counsel with Vivian, or with the Merlin. They had wrought all this trouble. Had they abandoned her now? Why did they not come to see how their plans lay all in wreck? Had they found some other woman of the correct lineage to throw her into Uther's path, to bear this king who would one day heal all the land and all the warring peoples? But no word or message came from Avalon, and Igraine was not allowed by the men-at-arms even to ride to the market-town. Gaulois, so the men said respectfully, had forbidden it because of the state of the country. Once, looking from the high window, she saw a rider approaching, and on the inner causeway stopped to parley with the head man of the guards. The rider looked angry, and seemed to Igraine to look up at the walls in frustration. But finally he turned his back and rode away, and Igraine wondered if this had been a messenger sent to her whom the guardsman wouldn't allow access. She was then a prisoner in her husband's castle. He might say, or even believe, that he had placed her there for her own protection against the turmoil in the land. But the truth was otherwise. His jealousy had led him to imprison her there. She tested her theory a few days later, calling the head of the guards to her. "I wish to send a message to my sister, asking her to come and visit," she said. "Will you send a man with a message to Avalon?" It seemed to her that the man avoided her eyes. He said,
"Well now, lady, I can't do that.
My Lord of Cornwall said very explicitly that all of us were to stay right here and protect Tintagel in case of a siege.
Can't you hire a rider in the village, then, to make the journey, if I paid the man well?
My lord wouldn't like that, lady. I'm sorry.
I see, she said, and sent him away. She hadn't yet come to the point of desperation at which she would try to bribe one of the men. But the more she pondered this, the angrier she grew. How dared Gorlois imprison her here, she who was sister to the Lady of Avalon? She was his wife, not his slave or servant. At last she resolved on a desperate step. She had not been trained in the sight. She had used it a little, spontaneously, as a girl, but except for her brief vision of Vivian, she had never used it at all as a grown woman, and since her vision of Gorlois as death-doomed, she had closed herself firmly to further visions.
That one, the gods knew, had come to nothing, for Gorlois was still very much alive.
Yet somehow, she supposed, she might now manage to see what was to happen. It was a dangerous step. She had been reared on tales of what befell those who meddled in arts to which they were not trained, and at first she sought to compromise. As the first leaves began to yellow, she called the chief of the men-at-arms to her again. "I cannot stay here for ever, shut like a rat in a trap," she said. "I must go to the market fair. We must buy dyes, and there is need of a new milk-goat, and of needles and pins, and many things for the winter which comes."
"Lady, I have no orders to let you go abroad," he said, and turned his eyes from her. "I take my orders from my lord, and I have heard nothing from him."
"Then I will stay here and send one of my women," she said. "Etar or Isotta shall go, and the Lady Morgause with her. Will that suffice?" He looked relieved, as she had hit upon a solution to save him from disobeying his lord. For indeed it was necessary that someone from the household should visit a fair before the winter, and he knew it as well as she did. It was outrageous to keep the lady of the house from what was, after all, one of her proper duties. Morgause was wildly happy when Ygraine told her she was to go. "Small wonder," Ygraine thought, "none of us has been abroad all this summer. The very shepherds are freer than we, for they at least take the sheep to graze on the mainland." She watched, frankly envious, as Morgause put on the crimson cloak Gorlois had given her, and, with the chaperonage of two men-at-arms, as well as both Etar and Isotta, and two of the kitchen women to carry packages and goods, set forth on her pony. She watched from the causeway, holding Morgaine by the hand, until they were out of sight, and felt that she could not endure to re-enter the castle which had become a prison to her. "Mother," Morgaine asked at her side, "why can we not go to the market with Auntie?"
"Because your father does not wish us to go, my poppet."
"Why doesn't he want us to go? Does he think we will be naughty?"
Ygraine laughed and said, "Indeed, I think that is what he believes, daughter." Morgaine was silent. A small, quiet, self-possessed little creature, her dark hair now long enough to plait into a little braid halfway down her shoulder blades, but so fine and straight that it slipped out into loose elf locks around her shoulders. Her eyes were dark and serious, and her eyebrows straight and level, so heavy already that they were the most definite feature of her face.
"A little fairy woman," Ygraine thought. "Not human at all. A pixie."
She was no larger than the shepherd girl's babe, who was not quite 2, though Morgaine was nearing 4, and spoke as clearly and thoughtfully as a great girl of 8 or 9. Ygraine caught up the child in her arms and hugged her.
"My little changeling."
Morgaine suffered the caress, and even kissed her mother in return, which surprised Ygraine, for Morgaine was not a demonstrative child. But soon she began to stir fretfully. She wasn't the kind of child who wished to be held for long. She would do everything for herself. She had even begun to dress herself and buckle her own shoes on her feet. Igraine set her down, and Morgaine walked sedately at her side back into the castle. Igraine sat down at her loom, telling Morgaine to take her spindle and sit beside her. The little girl obeyed, and Igraine, setting her shuttle in motion, stopped for a moment to watch her. She was neat-handed and precise. Her thread was clumsy, but she twirled the spindle deftly as if it were a toy, twisting it between her small fingers. If her hands were bigger, she would already spin as well as more gauze. After a time, Morgaine said,
"I do not remember my father, mother. Where is he?"
"He is away with his soldiers in the summer country, daughter."
"When will he come home?"
"I don't know, Morgaine. Do you want him to come home?"
She considered a moment. "No," she said. "Because when he was here, I remember it just a little. I had to go to sleep in Auntie's room, and it was dark there, and I was afraid at first. Of course, I was very little then," she added solemnly, and Igraine concealed a smile.
After a minute she went on,
"And I don't want him to come home because he made you cry."
Well, Vivian had said it. Women didn't give babes enough credit for understanding what was going on around them.
"Why don't you have another baby, mother? Other women have a baby as soon as the older one is weaned, and I'm already 4. I heard Isotta say you should have given me a baby brother. I think I would like to have a little brother to play with, or even a little sister."
Igraine actually started to say, "Because your father Gaulois," and then stopped herself. No matter how adult Morgaine might sound, she was only 4 years old, and Igraine couldn't confide such things to her.
"Because the mother goddess did not see fit to send me a son, child."
Father Columba came out on the terrace.
He said austerely, "You should not talk to the child of goddesses and superstition.
Gaulois wishes her to be reared as a good Christian maiden. Morgaine, your mother did not have a son because your father was angry with her, and God withheld a son to punish her for her sinful will." Not for the first time, Igraine felt that she would like to throw her shuttle at this black crow of ill omen. Had Gaulois confessed to this man? Was he aware of all that had passed between them? She had often wondered that, in the moons that had passed, but she had never had any excuse to ask, and knew he wouldn't tell her if she did. Suddenly Morgaine stood up and made a face at the priest.
"Go away, old man," she said clearly. "I don't like you. You have made my mother cry. My mother knows more than you do. And if she says it is the goddess who didn't send her a child, I will believe what she says, and not what you say, because my mother doesn't tell lies."
Father Columba said angrily to Igraine, "Now you see what comes of your wilfulness, my lady. That child should be beaten. Give her to me, and I will punish her for her disrespect." And at this, all Igraine's rage and rebelliousness exploded. Father Columba had advanced toward Morgaine, who stood without flinching. Igraine stepped between them.
"If you lay a hand on my daughter, priest," she said, "I will kill you where you stand. My husband brought you here, and I cannot send you away. But on the day you come into my presence again, I will spit on you. Get out of my sight."
He stood his ground.
"My Lord Gaulois entrusted me with the spiritual well-being of this entire household, my lady, and I am not given to pride, so I will forgive what you have said."
"I care as little for your forgiveness as for that of the billy-goat. Get out of my sight,
or I will call my serving women and have you put out. Unless you want to be carried out of here, old man, get from here, and do not presume to come into my presence until I send for you. And that will be when the sun rises over Western Ireland. Go!
The priest stared at her blazing eyes, at her uplifted hand, and scuttled out of the room. Now that she had committed an act of open rebellion, she was paralyzed at her own temerity. But at least it had freed her from the priest, and freed Morgaine, too. She would not have her daughter brought up to feel shame at her own womanhood. Morgause came back late that night from the fair, having chosen all her purchases carefully. Igraine knew she couldn't have done better herself. With a lump of loaf sugar for Morgaine to suck, which she had bought with her own pocket money, and full of tales from the marketplace. The sisters sat until midnight in Igraine's room, talking long after Morgaine had fallen asleep, sucking on her sugar candy, her small face sticky and her hands still clutching it. Igraine took it away and wrapped it for her, and came back to ask further news of Morgause. "This is ignoble, that I must hear news from the marketplace about the doings of my own husband."
"There is a great gathering in the summer country," Morgause said. "They say that the Merlin has made peace between Lot and Uther. They say, too, that Ban of Less Britain has allied with them and is sending them horses brought from Spain."
She stumbled a little over the name.
"Where is that, Igraine? Is it in Rome?"
"No. But it is far in the south, nearer than we to Rome by many, many leagues," Igraine told her.
"There was a battle with the Saxons, and Uther was there with the dragon banner," Morgause told her. "I heard a harper telling it like a ballad, how the Duke of Cornwall had imprisoned his lady in Tintagel."
In the darkness, Igraine could see that the girl's eyes were wide, her lips parted.
"Igraine, tell me true. Was Uther your lover?"
"He was not," Igraine said.
"But Gorlois believed he was, and that is why he quarrelled with Uther. He didn't believe me when I told him the truth."
Her throat choked with tears.
"I wish now that it had been the truth." "They say King Lot is handsomer than Uther," Morgause said, "and that he is seeking a wife. And it is whispered in gossip that he would challenge Uther to be High King if he thought he could do so safely. Is he handsomer than Uther? Is Uther as godlike as they say, Igraine?"
She shook her head. "I don't know, Morgause."
"Why? They say he was your lover."
"I don't care what they say," Igraine interrupted her.
"But as for that, I suppose as the world reckons such things, both of them are fine-looking men, Lot dark, and Uther blonde like a Northman. But it was not for his fair face that I thought Uther the better man."
"What was it, then?"
asked Morgause, bright and inquisitive. And Igraine sighed, knowing the young girl wouldn't understand. But the hunger to share at least a little of what she felt, and could never say to anyone, drove her to say, "Why? I hardly know. Only, it was as if I had known him from the beginning of the world. As if he could never be strange to me, whatever he did, or whatever befell between us."
"But if he never so much as kissed you?"
"It doesn't matter," Igraine said wearily. And then at last, weeping, said what she had known for a long time now, and had been unwilling to admit. "Even should I never look upon his face in this life, I am bound to him, and I shall be so bound until I die. And I cannot believe the goddess would have wrought this upheaval in my life if I was meant never again to see him." By the dim light, she could see that Morgause was looking at her with awe, and a measure of envy,
as if in the younger girl's eyes Igraine had suddenly become the heroine of some old romantic tale. She wanted to say to her, "No, it isn't like that. It isn't romantic at all. It is simply what has happened." But she knew there was no way to say that, for Morgause had not the experience to tell romance from this sort of ultimate reality, rock hard at the bottom of imagination or fantasy. "Let her think it romance, then, if it pleases her," Igraine thought, and realized that this kind of reality would never come to Morgause. It was a different world she lived in. Now she had taken the step of alienating the priest who was Gauloise's man, and another step in confessing to Morgause that she loved Uther. Vivian had said something of worlds drawing apart, one from the other, and it seemed to Igraine as if she had begun to dwell on some world apart from the ordinary one, in which Gauloise, perhaps, had a right to expect that she be his faithful chattel, servant, slave, his wife. Only Morgaine now bound her to that world. She looked at the sticky-handed, sleeping child, her dark hair scattered wildly around her, and at her wide-eyed younger sister, and wondered if, at the call of this thing that had happened to her, she would abandon even these last hostages which held her to the real world. The thought gave great pain, but inside herself she whispered, "Yes, even that." And so the next step, which she had feared so greatly, became simple to her. She lay awake that night between Morgause and her child, trying to decide what she must do. Should she run away and trust to Uther's part in the vision to find her? Almost at once she rejected that thought. Should she send Morgause with secret instructions to flee to Avalon and bear a message that she was imprisoned? No. If it was common talk, a ballad in the marketplace, that she was imprisoned, her sister would have come to her if she thought that it would help. And ever at her heart gnawed the silent voice of doubt and despair. Her vision had been a false one. Or perhaps, when she hadn't flung all aside for Uther, they had abandoned the plan, found another woman for Uther and the saving of Britain, as, should the High Priestess be ill for the great celebration, they would choose another for her part. Toward morning, as the sky was already paling, she fell into a dazed sleep. And there, when she had ceased to hope for it, she found guidance. Just as she woke, it was as if a voice said inside her mind, "Rid yourself for this one day of the child and the maiden, and you will know what to do." The day dawned clear and shining, and as they broke their fast on goat's cheese and new-baked bread, Morgause looked at the shining sea and said, "I'm so weary of staying within doors. I didn't know till yesterday at the market how weary I am grown of this house." "Take Morgaine, then, and go out for the day with the shepherd woman," Igraine suggested. "She too would like to go abroad, I imagine." She wrapped up slices of meat and bread for them. To Morgaine it was like a festival. Igraine saw them go, hoping now for some way to evade the watchful eyes of Father Columba. For although he followed her will and hadn't spoken to her, his eyes followed her everywhere. But at mid-morning, as she sat weaving, he came into her presence and said, "Lady." She didn't look up at him. "I bade you stay away from me, priest. Complain of me to Gauloise when he comes home, if you will, but do not speak to me." "One of Gauloise's men has been hurt in a fall from the cliffs. His comrades think he is dying and have bidden me to come to him. You need not be afraid. You will be properly guarded." She had known that. It had never occurred to her that if she could get rid of the priest, she might somehow make her escape. In any case, where could she go? This was Gorloise's country, and none of his people would shelter an escaped wife from his wrath. Simple flight had never been her intention.
Go, and the devil take you, so that you come not into my presence.
And turned her back. If you presume to curse me, woman.
Why should I waste my breath with a curse?
I would as willingly bid you Godspeed to your own heaven, and may your God find more pleasure in your company than I do.
Once he had gone, hurrying on his little donkey across the causeway, she knew why she had felt she must rid herself of the priest. In his own way, he was an initiate of the mysteries, though they were not her mysteries, and he would be quick to know and to disapprove of what she meant to do. She went to Morgause's room and found the silver mirror. Then she went down to the kitchens to ask the serving women to make a fire in her room. They stared, for the day wasn't cold, but she repeated it as if it were the most normal thing in the world, and fetched herself a few other things from the kitchen, salt and a little oil, a bit of bread and a small flask of wine. These, no doubt, the women thought she wanted for her noon meal, and she took a bit of cheese, too, to conceal her intent, and later flung it to the seagulls. Outside, in the garden, she found lavender flowers and managed to find a few wild rose hips. Boughs of juniper, too, she cut with her own small knife. Only a few symbolic branches, and a small piece of hazel. Once in her room again, she drew the bolt and stripped off her garments, standing naked and shivering before the fire. She had never done this, and knew Vivian wouldn't approve. For those who were unskilled in the arts of sorcery could cause trouble for themselves by meddling with it. But with these things, she knew, she could conjure the sight, even if she had it not. She cast the juniper on the fire, and as the smoke rose, bound the branch of hazel to her forehead. She laid fruit and flowers before the fire, then touched salt and oil to her breast, took a bite of the bread and a sip of the wine, then, trembling, laid the silver mirror where the firelight shone on it, and from the barrel which was kept for washing the women's hair, poured clear rainwater across the silver surface of the mirror. She whispered, "By common things and by uncommon, by water and fire, salt and oil and wine, by fruit and flowers together, I beg you, goddess, let me see my sister, Vivian." Slowly, the surface of the water stirred. Igraine, in a sudden icy wind, shivered, wondering for a moment if the spell would fail, if her sorcery were blasphemy as well. The blurred face forming in the mirror was first her own. Then slowly it shifted, changed, was the awesome face of the goddess, with the rowan berries bound about her brow. And then, as it cleared and steadied, Igraine saw, but not, as she had hoped and foreseen, into a living, speaking face. She looked into a room which she knew. It had once been the chamber of her mother at Avalon, and there were women there, in the dark robes of priestesses, and at first she looked in vain for her sister, for the women were coming and going, and moving back and forth, and there was confusion in the chamber. And then she saw her sister, Vivian. She looked weary and ill and drawn, and she was walking back and forth, leaning on the arm of one of the other priestesses, and Igraine knew, in horror, what she saw. For Vivian, in her pale robe of undyed wool, was heavy with child, her belly swollen, her face dragged down with suffering, and ever she walked and walked, as Igraine remembered the midwives had made her do when she was in labour with Morgaine. "No, no! Oh, Mother Caridwen, blessed goddess, no! Our mother so died, but Vivian was so sure she was past childbearing.
and now she will die. She cannot bear a child at her age and live. Why, when she knew she had conceived, did she not take some potion to rid her of the child?